Ladies, we'll have to begin if you'll find a seat, please. I welcome you all to the fourth meeting of this very fine program. Most people that are speaking on this program are PhDs or candidates for PhDs. This evening, we're going to have two people speak on business in the Twin City area. And Susan Smith, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Minnesota in American Studies, will introduce the speaker. Susan?
Thank you, Nancy. I'll be very brief so we can get to our speakers. I'm serving mainly to help with the discussion tonight and to introduce the speakers to you and sort of put them in context with the program you've been having. Your first two sessions were on education, first with the public schools and then higher education. And I understand that last week you were talking about women in the labor force. Well, tonight we're going to be talking about women in the labor force in an all too unknown capacity, and that's women in leadership positions, what we might call women in white-collar jobs, if you will, to speak very broadly. Our first speaker tonight is Professor Herbert Heinemann from the University of Minnesota in the Department of Industrial Relations in the Business School at the university.
Thank you for that very mercifully kind introduction. I appreciate it very much. If you hear my knees shaking up here, it's because of all the groups that I talk to. I think the AUW is the absolute tops when it comes to raising hell in the question and answer sessions afterwards. And I can remember one time I was lucky to get out of this beautiful Mayo home at Rochester. I don't know how many of you have ever been there for a meeting, but boy, that was really very nice, and although they managed to staunch the blood, why, I did get out. And as I recall, at that time, the Rochester paper had been speaking on somewhat a similar subject. Had a little headline the next day, one of those little dinky things that said, Heinemann shows the need of college education. And tonight, I'm going to try to demonstrate, I think, that that's true. At the outset, I certainly want to establish my chauvinistic connections by pointing out this works both ways for both sexes. My wife is one of the few people I know who loves to tell any and all who will listen that how she's one of the few people that slept with three all-conference football players in the same bed. She doesn't add that she has two sons, you see, and so it makes a little bit difference. Tonight, there have been several sort of titles in my talk. One of them ended up the way I kind of like it. It said something. I was going to talk about women in leadership position and the facts of life. And whenever you hear somebody going to tell you about the facts of life or the absolute truth or something, you know that you're going to be in for a fable instead. And tonight, of course, is no exception. Perhaps my fable could be entitled, The Ant and the Grasshopper, or a subtitle might be, You've Come a Long Way, Baby, but if you want more good jobs for women, you better go down the right road. And that may be that we won't get there necessarily by leaning on the horn and blowing louder and louder, that it's possible to drive down a detour, and that we can end up just blowing the whole thing. So anyway, what I propose to do in as short a time as possible is to give you some of my biases, my conceptions, and my misconceptions, and then let you fire away at me in a question and answer session at the end of my tract. And I also have a good co-speaker colleague who perhaps will also help protect me when it gets a little too rough. I'm talking tonight about jobs for women, more jobs, especially better jobs, all aspects of that. I'm not going to talk tonight about subjects I don't know about, women's biological role, sex, mores, dress, and so forth. Start out with a few propositions. Jobs are of dominant importance in our society. In almost any economy, work is inescapable. Jobs are the principal source of income. From about two-thirds to three-fourths of our income in our nation comes from jobs. And I'd like to also add that income from jobs is transferred to those who don't have jobs, the aged, sick, unemployed, those on welfare. And so that since jobs are the basic form of economic security, but not an unlimited resource, nor is job income unlimited, it behooves us to look at this a little bit and study to see what this is all about. Those who would quarrel with that premise are invited to take a look at New York City tonight, and they could stand to do a little of that. In our society, jobs are both a means and an end. Not only a means to provide income, but also a means to accomplish social as well as personal objectives. In the United States, we're somewhat unique in that we regard work as respectable. We want people to have jobs that in and of themselves provide fulfillment and achievement needs. And again, I'd like to emphasize the uniqueness of this throughout history and throughout the world today. Those who dream of the great days of democracy in Greece, I'm sure, must realize there were maybe 100 or 2 Democrats with a small d that could sit around and philosophize. We had a huge slave economy. Work was so unrespectable in ancient China, for example, that men would grow great big long fingernails to prove that they didn't have to work and that they were above such things. But we in America today are attempting to show that we can have fulfillment and achievement in our work situations as well as elsewhere in our lives. We seek and crave job satisfaction and quality of life in the workplace. And we do all of this within a framework of freedoms. We have freedom to enter or leave the labor market. We have freedom to work part-time, to be an employer, to be an employee, self-employed, or not to work at all. We have freedom to change jobs and occupations. Somehow, we have to get some 90 million people into 35,000 different kinds of occupations at the right time, in the right place, and in the right amount. And with substantial lead times as we've shifted from a brawn power economy to a brain power economy. But I'd also again reemphasize that jobs are not only important in the economic sense, but equally important in the psychological and sociological senses. If you studied sociology, for example, you would approach this differently. From an economist, you would say that the functions of jobs are to create statuses, things of that type. They are an indication of a person's role. When you go up to somebody and start talking to them, you say, "What do you do?" And that doesn't mean you drink Coca-Cola instead of diet, right? But somebody says, "Well, I'm a school teacher," or somebody says, "I'm a garbage man," and immediately you get some sort of an indication in your mind as to what that person is. So at this point, I'd like to just say, I hope you'll agree with me, that jobs are very important, both quantitatively and qualitatively. Now let me move to a little something about human resources. Human resources get allocated in labor markets. Jobs are the way that we allocate, develop, utilize, and conserve our human resources. If we don't have enough jobs, then we waste human resources. And if we don't have jobs that use people's capacities to the fullest, we also waste human resources. If we were to train 500 physicians, for example, and use them just merely as snow shovelers, that'd be an example of waste of human resources. We would call this underutilization or underemployment of human resources. And this is one of the most currently striking features of our society, a large amount of underutilization or underemployment of human resources, and it's especially striking in the case of women, where we are not using them at their fullest capacities. There are several types of underemployment, yes. One is only part-time jobs. People might want to work longer hours, for example. That is relatively less important than this underutilization of capacities that I've been talking about. But it's terribly important to realize that we have to be careful in saying we'd like to have more jobs and then coming to the actualization of having more jobs, because unless there is a demand for jobs, then there are not going to be jobs. Somehow we have to recognize what you may have heard in early economics courses, that labor is a derived demand, and that unless somebody doesn't want to have a good or service done, there won't be jobs. This fact of life is very, very important, and it's sexless. This fact of life applies to both men and to women. Now, the labor markets run much less inefficiently. We have created many institutions that interfere with the satisfactory operation of labor markets. Some of them are deliberately designed to distort labor markets. Unions, for example, attempt to tip the scales in favor of their members and so forth. Whenever you have these distortions in the labor markets, you have what we call frictions. We have continued inefficient use of human resources. Now, when you have inefficient use of human resources and you have waste, it gives rise to fables like, oh, we already have too many college graduates, what are we going to do with them? Or we have too many PhDs, we have too many of this and too many of that. Well, this doesn't necessarily have to be so, because it must be followed by an if, and by a great big if. We have need for new use of human resources almost perpetually in this knowledge economy, in this post-industrial economy. Our needs are almost without limit, and so are the opportunities, because what we're doing at the present time is adjusting our whole lifestyle, our whole way of life, at a pace that's really sort of unprecedented before. Now, what's going to happen? I don't know, but I can tell you where the opportunity lies and what might be happening and what I think is needed. I think we have to swing around rather sharply and change our value systems a great deal so that we give new status and new recognition to job givers. We put so much attention upon job seekers that it becomes very, very difficult to remember that there are two blades of the scissors. Name calling, strikes, any other type of thing is not going to do the job. There is a price that has to be paid for this, and somebody has to be prepared to pay this particular price. So to put it bluntly, tonight my thesis for you, and one that maybe will provoke some argument, I hope, put it very bluntly, that if women want more jobs, and if they want better jobs, they can use a variety of alternatives and strategies, two of which I would like to mention briefly. First of all, you can help create more jobs. That's one way, so that there'll be enough jobs so that the women can have jobs. The second alternative is equally effective, perhaps, in the short run. You can take jobs away from other people. You can insist that your job rights will come at the expense of men, children, older people, black, Chicanos, Indians. Most of these groups are already disadvantaged. But just as if you really want income, you can go out and earn it, or you can go out and steal it, you have this particular opportunity as well. There are some sections of the Woman's Live movement that suggest this latter path, and I suggest that this is completely wrong morally, ethically, but more important, it's wrong economically. It just isn't going to work. It'll work a little bit in the short run, perhaps, and also create some of the doggonest battles you ever hope to see in your lives. Some of the battles vis-a-vis the unions, for example, are going to be extremely bloody. Some of the battles women versus blacks are not very nice to contemplate and think about. But this can only happen up to a certain point after you hit a redistribution of jobs, but not more jobs and not enough to go around. Then you will find that we have an empty victory on hand and we're really not any place that any of us wants to be. So it seems to me the preferable solution would be to try to seek to solve the job problem and to leave the and to emphasize now the demand blade of the scissors, how we're going to create more and better jobs. I would point out that this is a very, very viable alternative because women today are better educated. They have just as favorable employment attributes as men have, and that consequently we find that there is a contribution there to be made that we just can't afford to neglect. Let's put this so in just a little bit of perspective. I don't know what Hi Berman said last time, but I think we have to take just a little look at the world around us to see what kind of a job this is going to be if we should undertake this, because we're really out there sort of stuck in the mud right now in our society. We have unemployment running around 8 or 10%. We have inflation running 10 to 15%. We have double unemployment rates like that for some people. For youth, the unemployment rate is 20%. This is twice as high as it was in 1947. And if you're over at the university the way I am and see how scared the kids are, then you can't blame them. It doesn't look like it's getting any better. Blacks and minority group unemployment rates are double and so forth. Some groups have 40% unemployment rates. So we're starting from kind of a low point which we hope to dig out. We've decided as a matter of national policy to keep high unemployment as an antidote to inflation. But if anybody can tell me that we're successful in this and that we've got inflation licked, got another thing coming. It's easy enough to print more money, but that isn't going to solve it either. And yet it's precisely the shortage of money that may be the most important thing of all that we have to recognize and do something about. Note that there are several things we can do with our incomes. We're just like the grasshopper and the ant that I talked about in the fable. We can save and defer, which is a long-run view, or we can spend, which is what we're doing. Because there are several types of spending. There's consumption, and there's investment, and you pay a price. England offers a perfect example of that. After World War I, people were terribly tired, beat up, they'd had hard lives, and their industrial plant was shot. They had one of two choices. They could have put more money into plant and machinery, and build a good basis for jobs, or they could have put it in housing. They put it in housing, and it was a choice that was theirs to make. I don't criticize for making it, but they had no reason to expect economic miracles. When you make choices like that, you have to pay the price, and they did. Now, as long as we're sufficiently disinclined to not make this hard choice, if we seek gratification and instant gratification instead, we're going to be short of money for job creation, both for more jobs and for better jobs, and for better jobs and more jobs for women. We need to stimulate capital investment in productive assets. And most of you have heard, I'm sure, that the current figure for needed capital accumulation runs in the neighborhood of $4 trillion in the next 10 years, $4 trillion. And that would be just to hold even. Now, we are already putting aside less from our gross national product than most other developed nations. And I would like to say that perhaps as a nation, we might want to have the following slogan: grasshoppers, the summer will not always be with us. And I think that's particularly appropriate at the present time. Take just a look at some of the things that are happening. Welfare. I am not opposed to welfare, and I suppose people want to jump on me for saying this, but I think it needs to be said. Our welfare costs went up 20% last year. AFDC caseload alone averaged over 11 million people a month. But somebody might say, well, Herb, don't you care for children, you know? Yeah, I care for children. But the growth in the AFDC caseload was more for adults than it was for children. You take a look at some of these facts. The specifics here aren't as important as the principle. The print that I'd like to try to make. You can have more welfare, richer welfare, better welfare, whatever you want to describe it. You can have more goodies, but you can't have your cake and eat it too. As labor says, you can't kill, don't kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. So we have a choice, but I think our choice is heavily dependent upon what we want to do with capital formation, both in the private and public sectors. Now, what about women and their role? And I am mindful the clock is, not only am I boring, but we're running out of tape, and I think that's probably more important. Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that we don't call all work by the name of jobs. I like to think of my grandmother Bisey out at Lester Prairie. She did many things. She tilled the fields, she made cloth, clothing, butter, soap, butchered, all in addition to her standard role of kirkie, kinder, and cooking, children cooking in church. She worked alongside of any man, and she was a damn good producer. And I might say she didn't do this for pay, she didn't do it for much credit. And if you think times have changed too much, I just can't help but think of the mess in our living room. I think it was yesterday, I'm so mixed up, where my wife was working alongside of me unpaid. She helps me with my books, and we put an index together. She gets no credit, no pay for that either. But a lot of things that are called work go on sometimes, you see. But progress has released us from some of this burdensome toil and given us the opportunity to live better lives that go beyond mere subsistence and mere existence. Now, we hear a lot of talk, and I went through a lot of books just in case I didn't know what the hell this was all about, and I have concluded that this men versus women deal is a phony. I've always thought that, I've always taught that, that the concept of individual differences is the name of the game. Eli Ginsberg, a good friend of mine, does a great deal of work in this area, said, woman, though a gender, should be treated as an individual. And I think this is for the crux of the matter. From the job standpoint, variation within one sex, either male or female, is far, far more important and transcendent than in terms of motivation, abilities, aptitudes, interests, and so forth. The battle of the sexes is silly. Women have already proved themselves on the job, in any kind of job that you can think of in a brain power economy. They've entered the labor market in record numbers. Now, as they gain additional qualifications, and the reason I emphasize that, for a while, you know, we had a dip in the numbers and proportions of women going on to college. It took us a hell of a long time to get back where we were 40 years ago. This year, we're starting to get back to that again. I don't know what happened. I don't know if women are going to be homemakers. There are sort of vogues in the number sort of fads in the number of kids you're going to have and all sorts of things like that. Whatever it is, I don't think anybody really expected women to enter the labor force either in such numbers or to make such a substantial contribution. But notice, just think what would happen to our economy if they went out. We've got 30.5 million women in the labor force. They're now 40% of our labor force. 15% of men and only 5% of women, however, are in managerial occupations. Terrible underrepresentation there. It's true that women dominate education in the health fields, but let's just go to these leadership-type jobs where women are coming in record numbers. Women make up only 15% of all managers, only 7% of all physicians, only 21% of all professionals outside of education and health. But all this is changing fast. I can't emphasize how fast it's changing. The most recent survey that the Bureau of National Affairs made showed that we find that of the larger companies that participate in this survey, 56% of all companies have more women in management positions than they did 5 years ago. And I just can't tell you what the next shot's going to show, because it's going to show that this looks like nothing. Now, the various pressures of EEO are going to keep this rate accelerating. And enough women get qualified through education and experience, this rate is going to go on and up. And so on that score, there's good news. In my own field, the Master of Industrial Relations, a professional degree, we now have gone up in the last 3 or 4 years from about 5 or 10% women to about 30 or 40%. In no small measure, I'd like to point out, this not only represents our desire and need for these people in the field, but it is the crucial role of job opportunity that I'd like to represent. It wouldn't be possible, nor would they want to be in there, if they didn't have some assurance that they were needed in an effective way and going to have jobs when they finish. So here we come to another central fact of life. In a world of rapid change, the knowledge explosion, we have something else that's going to help this process. We have both knowledge obsolescence and job obsolescence. About one-third of all jobs are disappearing during the 1970s. They're going to be replaced by I don't know what. I just don't know what they're going to be replaced by. Somebody said, you know, education today, college education day, to be practical, must prepare you for jobs that don't exist and whose names we don't even know at the present time. So a lot of people that have jobs and think they're very secure in jobs and so forth are suddenly going to find that they're no longer needed. They're discarded. And the new opportunities for jobs are going to be so great that instead of it being impossible for women to get into these positions of leadership and the new skills, it's going to make it a lot easier than it ever seemed to be, than it ever was before. This knowledge obsolescence is going to turn out to be the great equalizer. The abilities to acquire the new knowledges and skills will create the opportunities if, and I'm back to my central theme like a bulldog and stubborn Dutchman that I am, if everybody, including women, will work at it and hard. Now, there are those who think the women's movement should devote its energies to the promotion of lesbianism, for example. That's their privilege. Or maybe they want to destroy our economic and social system. That's their privilege. They can feel free to do so. But they are not on the same course or road as those who wish to see women advance up the occupational ladder in both numbers and quality of jobs. Quite frankly, there's no question at all that women have faced a hell of a lot of unfair discrimination, way too much. But the point that I would make is that now that this has been so clearly established, I don't know about anybody who would argue with that, I think that now we have to turn around and see what we can do to see that there are enough jobs for all those who want them. How are we going to do this? Well, I'm practically out of time and only can suggest a few directions. I think if you really sincerely would like to see women advance in occupations, you have to help us set aside the $4 trillion or whatever it is. We need to have new plant and equipment. Maybe it's going to be new hospitals. I don't know. They're terribly expensive. But you can't have jobs for more doctors without more hospital and things of that type. We are creating through this knowledge economy not more factory jobs, but more service jobs, more professional jobs, and so forth. And many of these require expensive equipment. So I think that you ought to go out and say such things as this. I would like to see higher profits for corporate enterprise. I'd like to see them a hell of a lot higher than they are at the present time, because American industry and government are not putting aside enough money for this job creation. And it just isn't going to be there. There are no economic miracles. The old definition of economics, there ain't no free lunch, isn't going to be there. I would like to have you join in lobbying to cut the taxation on job givers, to change our laws and climate so that it pays to be a job giver, and not that a person gets penalized for being a public benefactor. I would like to see you join us in the fight on inflation. I think it's crucial that unless we're able to get this slowed down, we're never going to be able to lick this type of thing. I think you have to help us slow down welfare expansion, I'm sorry to say. I don't really know if all the 11,000 food stamp recipients at the University of California, Berkeley need food stamps. Maybe only 6,000 do. I'm not sure. But you realize that in the last 10 years, we've been able to raise our food stamp program from 500,000 recipients to over 20 million recipients. I don't know where it's going to go. This is only one of 1,000 things that could be given if we had more time. But I don't think we really want to rip off our children, women, minorities, and indeed our future as a nation by continuing to bask in the joys of a dimming summer. This grasshopper complex, believe me, is no fable. Let me conclude now by saying just several more things. How does this concern you in AEW? Well, I sure as hell don't tend to try to tell you what to do. You are fortunately extremely bright, stubborn, independent. You are, in the age of knowledge, you're a special asset. Actually, in a knowledge economy, you represent an asset that's more precious than energy resources or coal or something like that. There's an old friend of mine named Sumner Schlechter, who's now dead. He was at Harvard, a very famous labor economist. And he used to like to talk about recidivists. These were people who caused problems. A small proportion of people caused the problems of accidents, turnover, and things of that kind in our field. And when he was dying, he turned around to the concept. He never quite got to publish this. I got to talk with him about it. The concept of positive recidivists. There are only a few and small proportion of people who made things happen and who made things change. And I sort of look upon you people as positive recidivists, because if we're going to turn down the right road, we need more activists, especially from those who are qualified to provide such leadership, intellectual, moral, and social. As I understand it, AUW has been moving more and more to activism with a great track record of success. Tonight, my message is simple, then, even if wordy. I invite you to join the ranks of the ants. It's a horrible pun to point out that women are uniquely qualified for this role. But nevertheless, I urge you to consider a huge, devastating attack upon job creation. This is not some mystical, ephemeral dream. It is a reality that we can affect and attain. It'll take very, very great understanding, dedication, and effort. Women's record as a force for social change is so impressive that I would tell you honestly, I don't see how we can possibly get along without you. But it's not an unqualified record of success, because not enough people have put their shoulders at the wheel. Time again will permit me only one example, but I would point out, although you are a majority of the voters, your underrepresentation in the legislature and in Washington and so forth suggests that there's still more to be done. My call to action then will require a more strenuous effort, and my last fact of the evening is that men alone cannot do the job that's required. I'd like to repeat that. Men alone cannot do the job that's required in our nation, nor do I think this should be a sexual proposition. This is a great people and a great nation. We have a glorious heritage and a solid record of achievement. We do have the knowledge and the abilities to create a better tomorrow. To me, more and better jobs are the basic requirement. So as I say in conclusion, won't you please join up and help provide the necessary strength to make this possible? Thank you.
I'll have to correct one little thing she said. I'm not the first woman, I am the third. But the first two women that were on were very inactive, so I'm thinking of myself as being the first, because I will be the first very active person. The board of directors has notoriously been loaded with men for a long period of time, and not because it's their fault, but because there aren't enough women who are interested enough to get involved, and I all but hornswaggled them into the job. My topic is, I think, a little unique. I was trying to think of a title that would take it from way out, way up. I think that Dr. Heenum and I were probably exchanging thoughts. There must be some mental telepathy between us, because quite a few things he said here tonight were things that I had brought out in my writing my speech out, and there was a number of things that I certainly go along with. I was wondering if he was reading my notes or if I had been reading his. I'm, needless to say, I'm very pleased to be here, because I love to talk about the progress of women over the past 40, 50 years. This forced me to do some additional research, and it forced me to do some research back into my very young years, thinking about my progress. And I am going to tell you more about the progress that I have made and the things that have happened to me over my lifetime. I think that women have reached some of the greatest heights of achievement in the past 50 years, probably far beyond what we even expected. And the way it is continuing to go, I think, just like Dr. Heenemann says, that there will be a rapid increase of achievement right along, because women are recognizing that they are not only equal to men, but they owe men this. They owe men to the support and also get right out alongside of them and help solve some of the problems that we have. I believe that women, that there is a bottomless well of undeveloped talents in women. Since I opened my brokerage a year ago, I've had many people ask me where I got the courage from. And surprisingly enough, that the majority of the people who have asked me this question have been women. And I didn't think that it took that much courage, actually, to open a brokerage. I felt that if you want to do something badly enough, you can do it. It's just a matter of setting a goal and aiming at it. Women have a hesitancy to venture forth into what was pretty much a man's world. And I believe that the vast reservoir of undiscovered talents which ladies have, if they were ladled out and developed, not only would help solve some of the problems, but I believe that they would also, at the end of your life, you could say, I have lived a fulfilled life, a joyous life, because there's a great deal of joy in doing the things that you would like to do.
The growth of my life and the development of my talents, I sometimes think have a unique beginning, and yet as I thought more about it when I was writing this, I don't know that it is necessarily a unique beginning. Because back in the times when I was in school, there were a lot of people developing along these lines, certainly a lot of men, I don't know how many women. My parents settled in Princeton, Minnesota, which a lot of you probably know of. It's not too far north of here, 50, 60 miles. And that's been about 60 years ago. There were five of children born to them, and all raised in the country through grade school. We were subsidized a great deal by our grandparents during those years because my dad was a farmer, although he did not care much about farming. He worked on other farms and did some farming, and somehow or another we all were raised, fed, and were all healthy. Only two of the kids could go to high school. One of them, being a boy, was able to go into Princeton and work at a job and go through school. You might say he put himself through. The youngest sister was able to go to high school because by that time they had moved into Princeton, my parents had, and she was able to go to the school there. But the rest of us did not go to high school. And at the age of 14, I was pretty much self-supporting. Although I was living at home, I was doing housework, and I did something that I'll bet none of you have ever done or probably ever thought of doing. We had a large peat bog up north of where we lived, a few miles. They grew lots of onions and they grew lots of potatoes. And at that age, I was up working in the peat bog, weeding the onions and helping pick potatoes. I will say that for a kid of that age, it's a bad job because the weight of the potatoes, my brother used to come over and help me dump them into sacks. I'll never forget it because the weight actually was, and I think some of the back trouble that I had in future years was due to this, but it was necessary to help subsidize the rest of the family. At 16, I was a tall, skinny girl, and I was working in the big city of Minneapolis. My parents at that time were still living in Princeton. The jobs I've had since that period of time are so numerous that it's almost unbelievable, but just to name a few, I sold children's clothing, I sold cosmetics, I worked in drugstores, I did a lot of waitress work. I worked in a defense plant during the war, running various types of machinery. We were making 20-millimeter machine guns at that particular time. I worked in the Veterans Hospital out in Tacoma, Washington for a period of time as a nurse's aide, and then I worked in their post office when they began to weed out the nurse's aides when there was enough work just for the nurses. While I worked in the cosmetic department in Powers in Minneapolis, I went up to what was called a Stauffer Reducing Salon. You probably know the one down the street here, same thing. And I started taking some treatments, and I was kind of enthralled with the whole idea. So I heard that there was one in St. Paul that was for sale. And I went out and borrowed $1,000, and I went over to St. Paul, and I bought the system. It was in the Ham Building. And that's the time when I say, where in the world did I get the guts? I just don't think I had any brains. I just gambled. But I went on and made a living at this from 1950 until 1959. So I brought this one down here at, I think that was in 1950. I believe I started in 1949 and I brought it down here in 59. And as usual, I go along with something just so long, I learn all there is to know about it, and then I get very antsy and I decide to go into something more. I have to have a whole new field, a whole new challenge. So that's exactly what happened. I decided that I wanted to go into something else, and I investigated the field of insurance, went out and took some aptitude tests, and I was told that I'd be very good at selling insurance, but to me it was just not interesting because it wasn't tangible enough. And I knew somebody was in the real estate business. In fact, Virginia Locke, and I'm sure many of you know her, she was downtown and with Cushing Driscoll at that time, still is with Cushing Driscoll, and I started there for 6 months. Then I went out to work at the Jamber Real Estate Office in Highland, and I was there for over 15 years. And last year, once again, after all these years, I needed a new challenge. And so I opened my own brokerage. And everything falls into place. Every time I want to do something, everything begins to fall into place. I find a building and everything works out. And I think that has a little to do with a positive attitude. I always feel something happens when it needs to. My dad was a unique person. I always considered that he's a philosopher. He had the ability to do his own thinking. He was always analyzing and thinking, and he had a great deal of influence on me. He always encouraged all of us to develop our talents and abilities. I took our long discussions very seriously, and through reading and investigating, I recognized that being a woman cannot stop me from reaching any goal. Only my attitude can do this. The reducing business was primarily woman-oriented, therefore outside of the man's world, pretty much. The real estate business is one of men and women working as equals and earning as equals. Probably one of the first that this has happened. Needless to say, there's been times when I haven't felt totally accepted in the business. However, as time has gone on and my performance has improved, in some instances, I'd say, second to very few in the field. My earning power has been as good or better than many, many, many people, men or women, in this field. And as respect grew for me, I have moved into the position where I feel that I'm totally accepted by men, women, or whoever. And that's a matter of attitude again. And probably the feeling of not being accepted in the very beginning was just my attitude. Probably I was accepted. I believe that people who usually do not accept others are insecure in their own position in life, whether it be a man or a woman. It's been my experience that I can find acceptance and get along with all others in any given situation if, number one, if I'm not defensive. I've come to believe it's not very important to prove something to everyone or to prove anything to anyone else. I know what I know, and I'm not out to prove a thing. I'm out to reach goals, and I'm out to work towards them. And there's where my gratification comes from. If I know what I'm talking about, I believe that I'm accepted. In other words, why fake? Someone always knows if you're faking, and that someone usually is yourself. And what does that do to your self-image? So that is one of the things I work very hard towards is don't fake, just be myself. If I don't know something, so I don't know it, so what? If I recognize that others too have God-given talents, and even men, I remind gals, and I belong to the BPW and the League of Women Voters, and frequently we're talking about one thing or another, and I remind them very often that there are women chauvinists as well as men chauvinists. It is not certainly only belong to the, it certainly doesn't just belong to the men. If I carry on the work and responsibilities of my job, not asking or expecting different treatment because I'm a woman, again, I believe I will be accepted. Now let's go back to the role of women for many years past, that of the housewife and mother. How many times have you heard, and how many times have I heard, I'm sure we can say many, many times over, somebody will say, well, what do you do? And you'll say, I'm only a housewife. Women have demeaned themselves by this attitude. The role of a homemaker and mother is one of the most, if not the most, challenging jobs a woman can ever have. And I certainly agree with the doctor when he says that there's no, he's speaking of his grandmother, or was it your mother?
Grandmother.
No set hours. This is where I thought our mental telepathy came in. Low or no pay, little or no appreciation, every day a new experience, a new trauma, every day a new challenge. There's beginning to be a new respect for the career of the homemaker, as well there should be. It's a matter of attitude. We're the products of the home where we were born, nurtured, and grew to maturity. Is this not the source of our real beginning? How important is a housewife and mother? I believe most important, probably one of the most important jobs that any woman ever has, but it still is a matter of attitude. We have women moving into a very challenging field of efficiency experts today. There are more women who not only run a home, but work full or part-time outside the home. This can be done well once she becomes an efficiency expert. By becoming an efficiency expert, she can cut her working hours from 16 to 12 hours a day. There are quite a few women who go back to school when the children are in school to prepare for a career she will have after kids are grown and gone. This is part of the progress, and this is very encouraging. Our standard of living has reached a point where one income is not sufficient. Therefore, women have been forced to get into the job market. If they want to buy a home or own a second car, send the kids to college, or just have some extras. Some of the rather recent changes in the status of women are in financing. This is an area that I recognize a great deal about. Today, in the purchase of a home, the entire income of both husband and wife is used to qualify in buying this home. In the very beginning of my career, I remember the lender saying that they could not use a wife's income if she were apt to get pregnant, if she were going to have any more children. Then they just discounted all of her income. And then it got to the point where they used half of it. Now today, and I'm not sure if it's because the women are being more recognized, or they think it's more discriminatory, or if it's because of the advent of the pill. It can be both, or probably is both. Also, another thing that's happening is that we are selling homes to single women. Single women also can adopt children today, as well as single men can. So you have a lot more choices. You can choose to have a career and a family, whether you're married or not. We've come a long way. Recently, I have met, just because I've opened my own brokerage and doing my own closings, I've been running into quite a few lady attorneys. And I'm hearing some great things about the impact that they're making within their field. I know there are lady judges, there are quite a few lady doctors, and we have many more women in politics. Now, how about the women in the League of Women Voters? I'm sure a lot of you are members, and probably a lot of you are very familiar with what's happening within the League. Many of these women, I have discovered, are women, married women with growing children. And I have noticed that this is often the launching pad into the political arena. I understand that Ruby Hunt was a very active leaguer at one point. I'm sure much of the reason she is as knowledgeable as she is in her job today in the city council is due to the league work that she did over the many years. I've met Betty Green recently, who is now chairman of the county board. She has a background in the education field. And she is a dynamic person. Both of these gals, and the other day I went down to the planning commission for the league just to sit in and be a watcher, whatever you call it, and I met Carolyn Cochran. She is chairman of the city planning commission, and she is an attorney by profession. I know there are many, many more women in decision-making positions. It's very exciting to me to see the acceptance of the women in these roles. The admiration and recognition that they earn for their hard work and dedication come from both men and women. About 10 years ago, I was in Europe with a group of leaguers from all parts of the United States. We were traveling through mostly Czechoslovakia and Germany. We were in England and we were in France. But I noticed primarily, and we commented about it a great deal, that in Germany and in Czechoslovakia, there's some very, very active women's groups, and there are many, many, many of the women there who have gone into law, medicine, in areas that there's all too few of us in the United States. They're well ahead of us, and they're doing just doing a tremendous job. And these women that we met women's groups in the various countries, some of the most terrific women you've ever seen, and many, many of them had families, growing families. We seem to have a much slower rate of acceptance of women in the roles formerly held by men than do some of these European countries. I'm not sure why this is, but I hope that this will change, and I think it is changing. As the doctor has said, it is a tremendous waste of human talent and human resources. To sum up my comments, I'd like to say that if I were to leave you with one thought, it would be that if you're going to be accepted in what you may consider a man's world, act like you expect to be accepted. Be knowledgeable, be real, be genuine, be sincere, honest and open. You will be respected and accepted. Thank you.
take 5 minutes, there's coffee in the back, and help yourself. 5 minutes for coffee break.